Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 30th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R. Tucker?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing?
That's great. So, D.R., we have spoken many times on this show over the last few months about something called the Omnibus Energy Bill, which is a bill that is before the Massachusetts State House. A few weeks ago, that Omnibus Energy Bill was voted on by the House of Representatives, right? Which is the lower house of a bicameral legislature. The House of Representatives voted, and we made lots of jokes about how it was a minibus and half a bus and didn't have all the right stuff in it. Anyway, in parallel with all that was an omnibus bill that was being developed in the Massachusetts Senate, right, which is, of course, has its own authority to write its own bill. And they wrote a bill that mirrored in many ways the House bill, because they want to get to some kind of agreement. But the Senate bill was different. And so that Senate bill was separately voted on today. Right? Today was the day that the Senate took up the omnibus energy legislation and took the vote. And I guess, DR, let me ask you to tell everybody what happened with the omnibus energy bill today.
Well, the most critical point of the omnibus energy bill vote was that the Senate voted 39-0 unanimously to kill off the so-called pipeline tax, which is
basically
the proposal to stick it to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to force residents of Massachusetts to pay for new pipelines being built by natural gas companies. That was completely voted down, and it was just a
and that's the point that you and I and many people who want clean energy were quite adamant about demanding, right, that the new natural gas pipelines that are proposed not be paid for through a tax on your electricity rate, right? So that 39-0 vote, that's
exactly
a big deal, right?
Exactly. And it was great to see both sides, both philosophical sides, coming together on recognizing that that would simply screw the residents of Massachusetts.
Well, I'm taking personal credit for all that, because I called my senator last night and left a message on his cell phone. It was his office phone. I was quite explicit in what I wanted him to do. But but tell me, I think that there were, in addition to that sort of breakthrough amendment that prevents utilities from having this surcharge, this extra tax, the Senate bill in and of itself, I think, is a better bill than the House bill. From what I've read, that the Senate bill, so let's go back. What the House bill did was to say that there would be a requirement that the state build 1.2 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030 or something, right? And it turns out that the Senate bill changed that from 1.2 gigawatts up to 2 gigawatts, which was the magic number that everyone, at least people on the clean energy side, the magic number where at 2 gigawatts of wind power, all of a sudden that is the tipping point where the industry can take off and support itself, and Massachusetts gets that industry. The other big useful, or just as an aside, the Senate bill also allows the much beloved Cape Wind project to come back and be part of the game, right? Whereas the House bill sort of ruled out Cape Wind, the Senate bill said, oh, yeah, you know, you can play along too. So they're back on an equal footing in the Senate bill. And the third.
And it's good to see the Senate with this vote blow away the final bit of opposition that's been going on for 15 years. Can you believe a decade and a half of opposition to this worthy project?
But the other useful and important thing that the Senate bill does over the House bill, right? So the House bill passed a few weeks ago. The Senate bill just passed today. The Senate bill calls for a 2% per year increase in the renewable portfolio standard. That is to say that at least 2% of each year, an additional 2% of our energy must come from clean sources. And that, of course, that 2% compounding interest, 2% compounding rate, that's a pretty good rate that drives up the introduction of clean energy. And that 2% number was something that clean energy advocates had been pushing for as well. So I think that the Senate bill began as a much more palatable bill, much more in keeping with what the real issue is.
Exactly.
And then the amendments, as you say, really kick in and did the other stuff that that was desired. And I guess one of the things that I read somewhere, I think it was in Commonwealth Magazine, said that, you know, part of this push to go to the 2 gigawatts was because the Supreme Judicial Court has recently said that the state has a responsibility under the Global Warming Solutions Act, right? We talked about that a few weeks ago.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's good to see the legislators, you know, take that ruling from the SJC seriously instead of simply blowing it off.
Yeah. I mean, I think that so as of, this is the 30th, right? As of today, the bill that has come out of the Senate is pretty good in most ways. I guess there was one way that was less happy, DR, from your perspective. What happened? What was the fly in the ointment for you?
Well, as it turns out, there was an amendment that was to establish a state-level carbon pricing, and unfortunately the amendment was apparently pulled by State Senator Michael Barrett, the sponsor of it, due to concerns that it would not receive sufficient support to pass. Apparently, he will be refiling this bill next year. But, you know, it is kind of depressing that, you know, with all the stories about carbon pricing legislation dying potentially in Washington state and having already died in Vermont, the idea that it dies this year in Massachusetts is not pleasant at all.
Yeah. Well, I think that we will continue to advocate for a price on carbon as we go forward. I'm sure that, it's not going to go away. But by and large, I think that Climate Hawks should be pretty happy with the bill that came out of the Senate. So, fine. The state of play right now, at least as far as I understand it, is that there are two versions of the Omnibus Energy Bill. Mm-hmm. One version has been passed by the House, and the other version has been passed by the Senate. And so now the House and Senate need to reconcile those two bills and make it into one document, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
That is where the next round of sort of political give and take and the next, I think, opportunity for Climate Hawks to get a word in here is that there's going to be some kind of a committee of state representatives and state senators that get together in some venue. I don't know, probably to be in the basement of the state house someplace with closed doors and whatnot. But I'm joking. But I mean, they have to get together and reconcile these two bills. And the question is whether or not the good features of the Senate bill will survive that reconciliation. Right.
It would be somewhat ironic if that basement were to get flooded due to sea level rise before they finished working on it.
Well, I mean, what I read was that at least as far as the forbidding of the pipeline tax, right? So the Senate bill says that the utilities cannot charge a fee on electricity users to build the pipelines that would feed the electricity plants, right? That's in the Senate bill, but there's something like 90 reps, that state reps on the other house, that wrote a letter saying that we should forbid this. The House of Representatives should forbid it also. So it seems like there's strong support in the House of Representatives to back up the amendment that was added to the bill in the Senate. So that's a good sign, I think, right?
Definitely, although you can imagine that the private sector advocates of such a pipeline tax will be making their voices heard, which is why opponents have to be making their voices heard as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think that, today is a good day as far as the Omnibus Energy Bill and Massachusetts's leadership on these kinds of issues. We will be paying close attention as the final bill. So I think what happens is that they have this committee to reconcile the two versions. They end up with one version, and then that version goes back to both the House and the Senate for some kind of pro forma approval, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if it's changed so much that people object to it, then the whole thing dies. But mm-hmm. the opportunity to have a single bill that goes through both houses is the next turn of events, right?
Exactly, exactly. And finally, the state can sort of be in compliance with the law that the SJC said the state was not in
that's
compliance
right. That's with. Right. That's right. No, it's good. It's good. So, kudos to the Massachusetts Senate. That's a good thing. There's that story. Then there's a different story, mm-hmm. which is more confusing. And mm-hmm. this second story has to do with something that we talked about before. But, I mean, these are continuing stories that evolve. There's a narrative around it. There's, you know, things that happen. The other story has to do with the Exxon New, the mm-hmm. pound Exxon New about climate change in 1977 with consequent attorneys general of various states thinking that they should investigate Exxon for fraud, for mm-hmm. telling their shareholders not to worry when, in fact, their shareholders had very deep reasons to worry.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, DR, you're our legal eagle. What kind of went on this week in the Exxon New about climate change story?
Well, in a major development, the Attorney General for the Virgin Islands, Claude Walker, vacated the subpoena he had issued against ExxonMobil and against some of the so-called think tanks that ExxonMobil had financed over the years. This subpoena was going to be very, very extensive, similar to the subpoena that Attorney General Maura Healey in Massachusetts issued to Exxon to try to determine whether or not they were engaging in between what they were privately acknowledging about climate change and what they were acknowledging to the public. Also, according to thehill.com, Attorney General Healey has said that she will not pursue her investigation of ExxonMobil while Exxon is filing its two legal challenges to the investigation, one in Texas federal court and the other in Massachusetts Suffolk Superior Court. So it's very, very unusual that the subpoena has been vacated by Virgin Islands Attorney General Walker, and it's occurring at the same time as an extensive story in the Wall Street Journal indicating that Exxon is now appearing to sincerely beginning to lobby members of Congress and other oil companies on the merits of revenue-neutral carbon tax legislation. And it does raise the prospect that is ExxonMobil trying to do this as a way to sort of take the wind out of the sails of the Exxon New movement, with the idea being that if they are sincere in lobbying for carbon pricing legislation, these attorneys general look like they're being sort of, engaging in excessive legal force by going against an ally, a perceived ally of carbon pricing legislation. Is this a bit of jujitsu by ExxonMobil? Are they trying to sort of turn the tide of public opinion against people like Maura Healey and New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who's running his own investigation by basically saying that, hey, why are you guys quote unquote harassing an ally in the fight to price carbon?
So you say if I killed a guy yesterday, but today I'm friendly with the prosecutor, that I shouldn't be prosecuted for killing the guy yesterday if I'm a nice guy today?
It appears that Exxon is pursuing a sort of a go forth and sin no more strategy, basically, we might have done wrong in the past, but we're making it right now.
So,
and why
are you going to beat up on
a guy for making it right now? I guess.
What do you think of the sincerity of what Exxon is doing? I mean, I guess I'm not that familiar with what Exxon is saying, but mm-hmm. I would look with a squinty eye at anything that Exxon says that they're going to promise to do until they until they really, really demonstrate good faith. I mean, do you think they're sincere?
Well, the Wall Street Journal notes as part of its story that Exxon may be anticipating a changing of the guard in the in Congress and in
I can't imagine why they would anticipate changing of the guard. Huh?
And if and as I've we speculated before, if there is such a changing of the guard, one of the highest priorities is going to be climate and energy legislation 7 years after the failure of the Waxman-Markey bill in the Senate after it passed the House. And they and obviously ExxonMobil has to know that if there's going to be such legislation, they would want legislation that does the least amount of harm to their interests. Obviously, there's widespread speculation that ExxonMobil, one of the reasons why that they're comfortable with revenue neutral carbon pricing is that it would not damage their natural gas holdings and they could begin to transition to natural gas. And also, if you think about it from a longer term perspective, you would figure that these oil companies would look at somebody like Elon Musk and say, boy, let's make sure this guy doesn't put us out of business. We could put him out of business. And if there was carbon pricing, if you had federal carbon pricing policy, that would make it easier for Exxon and other oil companies to start going into low carbon vehicles themselves, low carbon energy policies themselves, and potentially kill off a competitor before he kills them off. So it would be in the strategic interest, if they were thinking long term, to push for revenue neutral carbon pricing to make sure that Elon Musk doesn't eat their lunch one day.
DR, you play three-dimensional chess much better than I do, so I'll just leave that statement there. I mean, we will watch with an attentive eye to see what Exxon does, because, again, this story is one of those things that's not going to go away, but this is the latest turn of the screw, huh? So we'll put up links to the things that we've talked about here, as many as we can, on the blog that's associated with the podcast. That blog and podcast will be at massclimateaction.net/blog. Please go and leave us a comment. Please donate to MCAN when you get there. Of course, you can find the podcast on our Facebook page. It's Facebook.com/massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends so that they can learn about climate stuff as well. Of course, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And you can always find us on iTunes, the mother load of all podcasts, but then, you know, on iTunes you can find us. Just search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we will close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States, and hopefully next year the state of Massachusetts, will put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
And we'll see if Exxon helps out in that respect.
Thanks to everyone for listening. It's great to have you here. We'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool. All right, I better save that.